I will now call the third and final oral argument of the day for this panel. That case is number A23-441, Wayne Willenberg and others versus Charles Fry and others. Council, I assume, are familiar with our protocols. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, you may approach the lectern. Please identify yourself and your clients, and then you may begin.
If it may please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Eric Hansen. I represent the appellants in this matter. Those consist of the Fries, Krauses, Maduras, and Nelsons. This case presents, I think, can be broken into two subsets. First is, could this easement be moved when it was defined? That's the first question we have to grapple with. The second question is, assuming that it could be moved, did the respondents in this matter manage to meet the requirements of Section 4.8? I'm going to start with the first of those questions, whether or not it could be moved. And really, the answer to this question really turns on the language of the restatement. And I think that it's important that the court start there. And specifically what I'm talking about is Section 4.8 of the Restatement, Third of Property Servitudes. And it says right at the start of it, except where the location and dimensions are determined by the instrument or circumstances surrounding creation of a servitude, they are determined as follows. And it goes on. What this is saying is that unlike an easement where it just says we're going to grant ingress and egress, if your easement instrument defines where your easement is, you can't move it without the consent of the other party.
I'd like to stop you briefly, Mr. Hansen. You say the appeal turns on the language of the restatement. Are you assuming the restatement applies? Are you conceding that?
I believe it does. I will submit that Minnesota has a, I would say, paucity of case law on the subject. I think that's reflected in the district court's decision. Hasn't really been decided, I would say. The last time that it was, you know, seriously discussed was nearly 100 years ago. So I do believe that the restatement applies. Certainly that's what the district court...
I mean, why? Why isn't our just general easement law enough? We have a plain and unambiguous instrument. Why don't we just apply the language of the plain and unambiguous instrument? Why are we even looking at the restatement?
I think you get to the same result, respectfully.
But Counselor, the easement itself provides a process for alteration.
It does. It provides a process, and you know, if we go back beyond the restatement, and if you look at the restatement, all of our case law about this, both that does and doesn't apply the restatement, deals with this idea that these easements are contracts, and that the terms of the contract is what is to be enforced. And here, there is a process whereby you can dissolve the easement, and it wasn't followed. And it wasn't followed because they couldn't get the unanimity that was required to modify the easement.
But what's the language in there that refers to five lots then can call for an alteration of the roads?
Specifically, I'll make sure that I'm quoting it correctly.
It's in that paragraph that starts initially a 24-foot wide gravel road. And then it talks about alterations shall be approved in writing by the owners of 5 of 15 parcels. That doesn't sound unanimous. But.
I think you're correct, and I'm not finding it immediately. I think you were looking at addendum page
007, kind of?
007, thank you, Your Honor.
Like the spy?
Yes.
And then it's, you know, it's six lines down or so where, in the paragraph that starts initially a 24-foot wide gravel road.
Right. Therefore, each owner of each parcel covenants and agrees to pay 1/15. I guess where I'm drawing the unanimity had to do with some of the language with regard to the homeowners association. I think you are correct. It says each owner's, or road shall be approved in writing by the owners of five of the 15 parcels. I think that's the person, the portion you're referring to, Your Honor?
Yes.
I don't think that language allows five of the 15 parcel owners to move the easement.
What does alteration in the road then mean? It's not the location, but it's maybe whether it's gravel or tire or something else?
Right. And if you look at the context of that language, maintenance and repairing of the road is what they're talking about. And then this is then subsequently embodied in the association's rules and bylaws and talks about how they're going to divide maintenance costs for the road. And that was an issue, and an issue that was addressed by the district court and something that we've raised on appeal. And specifically, that basically the district court concluded that the association was not a necessary party, but then turned around and said, essentially, I've got the quote here in my notes, says that it will be the TRHA's responsibility to develop a strategy and, if necessary, amend its bylaws. That's addendum 96. That's the district court saying, this is, you know, I recognize that the distribution of payments for maintenance of this is handled by the association. They're not part of it. The association's going to have to do that separately and on its own.
But aren't the parties the association?
No. No, the parties are not the association. The parties are members of the association.
Okay, but who that isn't involved in this litigation is missing?
That's
a member.
That's true, but just as you would not and could not have a dispute involving a corporation and have that corporation's two shareholders be the opposing parties, you still have to have the corporation. There's a separate interest of that corporation that's not, that is the collective of the shareholders. And the same concept here. And there is a separate interest because there is a defined purpose for that association. And it's spelled out in its bylaws and was agreed to. And just saying that the members who are part of that association does not mean that the association is in the litigation. And I realize that we're jumping around a bit, but I think that really goes to the essential party question. And I find it difficult to understand how the district court, on the one hand, can say, well, you're going to have to modify your bylaws to deal with this problem we're creating, and then say they're not an essential party to the underlying dispute. Because as I read our case law, it is really, this question of is it impacting a vital interest of the entity is the test that we use. And here, you've got an association that's set up to do maintenance and allocate the expenses of that maintenance. You're going to say, we're going to modify that, but you don't have a right to be at the table. I respectfully disagree with the district court that does not render them an essential party, and I don't think that you can dodge that by saying, well, de facto, the shareholders are here, so that's the same as having the association here. That logic is contrary to all of our holdings with regard to corporations and that they have separate legal standing as an entity.
When you have an easement document that fixes the location of the property, or fixes the location of the easement, And then expressly prohibits alterations to the roadway. Under what circumstances, if ever, can a unilateral modification occur?
I would say never. The only way you could modify it would be, it would not be unilateral. It would be consent of all involved.
All involved.
All involved.
Unless the document, the easement, provides otherwise.
Correct. And I respect that the court, you know, I think there is a question of whether or not the restatement applies. We litigated this as if the restatement applies. And I do think that analysis remains the same in that if all of the case law that's cited for the proposition that it can be unilaterally moved really turns on this idea that it's a grant of a right, ingress, egress, as opposed to a fixed location. The use of the common wall, which is basically the only Minnesota case that I think is particularly on point on this, it doesn't define where that common law is. And so if you read those cases, it goes, then you get, you know, past this question of can it be moved at all, and you get into the further factors of the restatement. Is this a burden? Are you altering the use? Those sorts of questions.
Help me out with the record here, and I just don't recall. Was there some interim statement from the district court indicating that the restatement applied in this case before trial, that was the direction that it was heading, or was this just an assumption that was accepted by all of the parties at the inception of the action?
So to be clear, I came in midway in the trial on this one, but my recollection of the record is that there was an early motion to dismiss. And in that early motion to dismiss, the district court held that the restatement applied and then analyzed those factors. We, after my office took over, there was a subsequent summary judgment motion that I think had already been briefed. And then in the trial memorandums, it was that was basically the law of the case, that that's what we were fighting over, and that the district court had made it clear that it was analyzing it under the 4.8 rubric.
I understand. Thank you.
Did the district court ever focus on the preamble clause that you were talking about earlier, the one that begins except where ... And was that clause, you know, called to the district court's attention in district court proceedings?
I believe it was. Certainly my recollection is that that's front and center in the post-trial memos, which was after my office took over. And I know that inside baseball, but when we took over, we saw this issue, we raised it to the district court, that there was a fixed location for the easement, and that we thought that Section 4.8 did not apply because there was a fixed location for the easement. So that was raised, and it's raised in the record. The language of the restatement, including the preamble, was repeatedly brought to the district court's attention. Procedurally, that is something that had already been, shall we say, ruled on by the district court in that initial motion to dismiss, which was not my office, but it was raised subsequently.
If the panel were to agree with you that the preamble does not support respondent's position, does not support the district court's conclusion, what about your other arguments? You've got, I think, four different enumerated arguments. If we agree with you on that, then what happens to the other arguments?
If you agree with me on the primary point, I think the answer is it's just a reversal, and it cannot be moved, and then you don't need to get to any of the other issues. This whole issue of whether or not this was an advisory opinion and whether or not they met the factors of the restatement 4.8, you know, whether or not it was impacting the dominant estate, none of those things are things that this court has to grapple with, because I believe that this is very much a bright line test. If the court agrees that the easement is defined as to its location, then this section doesn't apply, and that's it. That's the end of this case, and it's reversed on that point.
And if that's the ultimate finding, then that doesn't necessarily prevent the subdivision of these lots. It just prevents the changes to the road.
Absolutely. And that has been the case all along. And in fact, I don't know how well this is fleshed out in the trial record, but I mean, that was discussed at trial. And in fact, one of the properties, I want to say it's the Carlson property, and I'm looking at addendum 100, which is the map. The Carlson property, it has been subdivided. They sold it to a different developer, and they basically did not alter the easement road and came in off the primary road. And so, yes.
Because they had a location that would allow that, though, huh?
Exactly, Your Honor. They had a way to do it that they concluded it was cost-effective. It is not that you cannot redevelop these other parcels. It goes to the cost development. I think that's borne out in the testimony that that's what's the driving force behind the desire to unilaterally relocate the easement. I see that my time has expired, so I apologize. I'll try to answer the remainder on rebuttal.
Mr. Hansen, is that in the record that the Carlson lot has been redeveloped, or is that something that occurred after the district court proceedings?
No, it was discussed during the trial testimony. I apologize that I do not have a cite to the transcript, it definitely was discussed that work was ongoing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you may approach. Please introduce yourself and your client or clients, and then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Paul Dworek, and I represent all the respondents. Your Honors, this case is about my client's right to reasonably relocate the easements in the neighborhood in a way that does no harm to their neighbor's easement rights, but allows them to maximize the value of their land and sell to TEG, and finally move on with their retirements. This case is also about neighbors trying to use easements for purposes for which they were never intended, or as Judge Wall aptly put, to try to breathe life back into this restrictive covenant that prevents subdivision that was abolished by the neighborhood in 2004. Judge Wall got this case right on all the fronts.
Help me out here. Are you claiming that there's some ambiguity in the easement?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what is the ambiguity?
The ambiguity in the easement is with the term alter. Alter needs to be read in context. It needs to be read knowing the sentence that comes before it, that the said roadway easement shall be used strictly for an easement of access of egress from and ingress to said parcels A through O. In other words, nobody can alter the right to ingress and egress, but it doesn't mean they can't change the location of the easement so long as it doesn't affect somebody's ability to get in and out of their property. And that's what Judge Wall held as well. I mean, Judge Wall said the prohibition against altering the easement could reasonably be interpreted to preclude only alteration to the access granted by the easement, not the easement itself. And I think that's important to know because this court doesn't need to agree that that is the best interpretation of that language, only that it's a reasonable interpretation of that language. And if it's a reasonable interpretation of that language, it can only be overturned for clear error. And it's not clear error. This easement document, when you read it, it fixes, Your Honor, the initial location of the roadway. There's nothing in there that says that it can never be changed or that that's going to be the location into eternity. It fixes the initial location, and that's it. And what it does is it makes clear that all it's giving is the right to ingress and egress, the right to get to your parcels, and nothing more. It's a right-of-way easement, and that's it. And right-of-way easements give you the right to passage. They don't give you a right to a particular path. And that's what Judge Wall said, and that's what he applied. Now, in regards to, Your Honor, in regards to the preamble of the restatement, that was argued and certainly was not applied or found to have no effect by Judge Wall, and that's rightfully so. The preamble comes from the restatement, and I think it's important to note the restatement is not a statute. The restatement is simply, you know, a secondary source that's used to distill concise rules or principles determining common law throughout the country. It needs to be read in conjunction with the comments and also the illustrations or the examples provided in. And when you read through that restatement with those comments and with those examples, it's clear that that preamble part doesn't apply to the third section, which is the relocation section. And that's not just me saying this. The Indiana Supreme Court in town of Estevill kind of did a detailed analysis of how that preamble is inconsistent with what the restatement wanted to do with Section C, Your Honor. And Judge Wall knew that. And if you look at the cases that from the other jurisdictions that kind of adopt this restatement and cite to the rule from the restatement in regards to relocating easements, they rarely ever cite to the preamble. They just don't include it as part of the rule. They just determine, unless really what the restatement stands for is, unless the easement instrument itself explicitly and unambiguously prohibits relocation, you can relocate so long as those four equitable factors are satisfied. And that's what Judge Wall did here.
Well, the preamble says, except where the location and dimensions are determined by the instrument, ... surrounding the creation. I mean, based on your answer to Judge Frisch's prior question about whether the document in the addendum is ambiguous or unambiguous, you said it's ambiguous with respect to the word alteration. But, I mean, under your view of that document would allow for a relocation. Is that what you're saying?
This allows for a relocation, correct?
No, but the paragraph 2 of, the declaration, the paragraph 2 on page 007 has the word altered. And I guess what you're saying is under your view, the relocation is not an alteration. So in other words, the easement declaration would govern the location of the roads. Doesn't that then still put this case within the accept clause of the restatement?
It doesn't, no, Your Honor. The except where the instrument itself prohibits relocation, that clause, there's nothing
about
this.
Well, it doesn't say prohibits, except where the location and dimensions are determined by the instrument, ... surrounding creation of a servitude.
The preamble, then.
What
I'm saying, my argument is the preamble doesn't apply to the relocation section of the restatement, Section C. When you read everything, when you read the comments, when you read the illustrations, and when you look at how jurisdictions are citing to that rule and applying it, the preamble doesn't apply.
Boy, I'm surprised by that. The preamble is a... It then sets up, they are determined as follows, 1, 2, 3. It seems like all three of the paragraphs, the rule statements that follow, are subject to the preamble. I don't see how they could not be.
And what I'll say to that, Your Honor, is the preamble is certainly not a statute. The preamble is there to guide kind of courts and also legal practitioners, and I just think it's written unclearly, and I think it's written erroneously in regards to that preamble and the way that jurisdictions are going about adopting this modern rule, which puts fairness over these bright line rules. They're just not applying it. And really, if you look at Minnesota, if you just take Minnesota, for example, Minnesota's got one case dealing with unilateral easement relocation, and that's Sabin v. Ray. And in that case, Minnesota looked at what's the harm, right? It rejected the bright line rule, and its analysis boiled down to what's the harm? What is the harm to the other people's easement rights? If there is no harm, we're going to let this person use their property in its best use. Appellants, and we're going to grant the change.
Appellant cited other cases as well on page 23 of its brief, cases such as Appitz, Highway 7, Larson, Bergen, Mission. Don't those cases state the the majority rule that is sort of alluded to in the restatement?
No, Your Honor, those cases don't deal with easement relocation or the unilateral relocation of an easement. They just, I think, deal with some, I think they cite them for more of the general proposition that easements are contracts and contracts should be interpreted. But where the contract is ambiguous as to whether or not somebody can relocate an easement, Minnesota applies the Sabin v. Ray. And Sabin v. Ray looks at the equitable analysis. And that's exactly what Judge Wall did. Judge Wall said the only law in Minnesota that's controlling on this issue is Sabin v. Ray.
Sabin, does it apply when the location of the easement is fixed?
Yes.
Why?
Yes, it does.
Why?
Well, easement locations can be fixed in the instrument itself, in the circumstances surrounding the creation of the instrument, or also because the grantee or the grantor picks a location and then the parties just acquiesce to it over the years. It can be fixed in any of those reasons. And if you look at all the case law, that's what it refers to as fixed. It's not just fixed in the initial instrument, but fixed, you know, in how did the parties go about it for the last
circumstance, I understand.
Yeah, 20 years, 100 years, something like that. And that's kind of the important point to note on this stuff is, you know, these contracts get drafted, but they live much, much longer than usually the drafter of them, right? And so if the person drafting these easement documents wants to prohibit relocation for eternity, well beyond their life, they need to expressly state so in that document. If they don't, if it's ambiguous, then the court and the courts in Minnesota get to do an equitable analysis.
What's the case or statute that says that?
That's the Sabin v. Ray, Your Honor, is the case. There's Sabin v. Ray, and there's also Thomas v. Merconage. Those are the only two cases in Minnesota dealing with kind of changes to easements.
But they're really not on point on that compared to this case, it doesn't seem to me.
Well, they both cases at bottom look at what's the harm? Like, what's the harm? Because we as a society want to maximize people's utility of their land. And if there's an easement, we want to make sure that that doesn't run interference with their easement rights. But we don't want to allow them to use easements for purposes for which they were never intended, or to use an ingress egress easement to bar the development or subdivision when that's not the purpose of it. So they look at it, both cases can kind of be condensed down to what's the harm? If there is no harm to the other side, then we're going to allow the change, because we don't want these easement holders to be beholden to unreasonable neighbors or unreasonable dominant estates.
Isn't Sabin different because the easement there was not, its location was not specifically specified in the grant, and therefore that the grantee, the servient estate, was allowed to locate it. Isn't it different from this case in that way?
The initial location was not fixed in that easement instrument itself. I think it was generally described, the parties kind of knew where it was. But once that stairwell and party wall was built, and used for, I think, 20-something years, it certainly became fixed. And so then you got the decision of, are we going to use this archaic rule of once an easement becomes fixed, it can't be changed without unanimous consent, or are we going to go with fairness and say, you can change it so long as it does no harm?
That was a really de minimis change, though, wasn't it?
The party wall?
Yeah.
I guess it depends in whose eyes, right?
This is not just a relocation. This is a big change. You're making part of this road system a city street.
Which really only benefits.
Are you sure?
The other side. Yes, Your Honor.
I can tell you out in the area I come from, people buy these big tracts of land because they don't want the city or the county messing with them, you know?
You got to look at what the easement document gives them. It gives them the right to ingress and egress, and that's it. The right to access their property, and that's it. It doesn't, and they get that right when it's converted over to a city street. They certainly get that right. They get a better road, and they get a road that they don't need to maintain. And that was part of those factors that Judge Wall looked at.
Would there have been any assessments for that road if this went forward?
It couldn't result in, if this goes forward, it couldn't result in any additional cost to them. That's part of the order of Judge Wall's order. It can't result in any additional cost to them.
So if there are assessments, the lots that are enjoying the subdividing would pay those assessments?
The lots or the developer, that purchased those lots and is seeking to develop them is going to incur those costs, certainly.
Because my experience on these kinds of things sometimes is that the city or township or whatever makes you build the road, and then they'll take it over and maintain it thereafter.
The city, under this proposed plan, the city would make the developer build that public road, but then they would take over the future maintenance, which then continues to give the neighbors, everybody in the neighborhood, ingress and egress rights without the burden associated with maintaining the private road, without having to pay for the upkeep themselves.
Where did, and this is historical, so maybe you don't know, but where did the 24 feet ever come from?
The 24 feet, it's in that...
why 24 feet?
Oh, I don't know.
Because usually you have a two-rod or four-rod or a larger road.
Okay.
You know, but a two-rod would be over 30 feet wide.
Yeah.
For the right-of-way.
Okay.
Judge Kirk is going to explain that to me in further detail when we're conference.
But they get a wider road. They get one that's not main, that they don't have to incur the burdens of, and they get the same, if not better, access to and from their properties. And I think as far as that 24 feet, that same paragraph in the easement document says initially a 24-foot gravel road will be installed. That indicates some, you know, this idea that it's going to change over time. So I think that's important to point out. But
Mr. Dwork, I'd like to read the first comment in the restatement and ask you to respond. It seems to me that this comment works against your position. It says the rules stated in this section, which is 4.8, apply only as an aid to determining the intent or expectations of the parties under the rules stated in a different section, and to supply terms omitted by the parties in creating a servitude. The parties are free to determine the location and dimensions of a servitude. If their intent to do so is ascertained, it should be given effect. It seems like that comment describes the preamble, and it describes how the preamble basically defers to an instrument if it determines these issues, and that therefore the 4.8 applies only if there is an absence of a provision in a document that determines the location and the dimensions.
To that, Your Honor, I would say that this document determines the initial location. It doesn't determine the location for eternity. And I think what the law is, and the way the restatements are applied in the jurisdictions adopting it, that unless the document fixes or bars relocation of the easement, it's allowed to be relocated down the road so long as it doesn't do any harm to the others. And that's what Judge Wall adopted. That's what we believe is the correct interpretation of the restatement. It's certainly consistent with the only Minnesota case on point, Sabin v. Ray, and we ask that the court affirm.
One more comment or question. You used the word eternity, which reminds me that the beginning of this paragraph says a non-exclusive perpetual private roadway easement, dot, dot, dot. I mean, isn't that some indication that the people who agreed to that document intended it to be permanent?
They intended that the right to ingress and egress remain permanent, certainly. But I don't believe that means the right to that, that the roadway is going to stay in that exact location forever.
Okay. Thank,
thank
you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
I'd like to begin, if I may, with following up on a comment from Judge Kirk. Representations made that they were going to enjoy wider streets and that these things were going to happen. And I think that it's an important point that this court understand that those aren't enforceable promises. TEG, the developer who's supposed to do all of these things, was never a party. They're a fact witness. And so one of the questions that we posed that I think there is not an answer to is what happens if this roadway easement is relocated and some other developer does something different with it. Because all of Judge Wall's findings that this isn't a burden on these people, that the maintenance costs are going to be paid by more people, or rather than what it is today, are all premised on promises made by TEG that are ultimately unenforceable. And the testimony was really clear on that at trial, that TEG ultimately said, well, I'm bound by the city's development plan. That's who I answer to. So if the city doesn't, for example, say that that TEG has to pave the entire 24th Street, there's nothing that compels it. And I think that that is a big problem here, and one which really tips this into the advisory opinion context, because the party who's supposed to be doing a number of things isn't bound here. And another party that's supposed to be doing things in terms of reallocating the costs was prohibited from being a party, the association. So I think those are important points. The fact that those are unanswered questions, I respect that you don't have to get there, because I think that the language of our easement is really clear. It is defined. It's laid out on a survey as to where it is, what its parameters are, that it's 24 feet, and we know where it is. You don't have to answer that question. But I think that as you're contemplating that, it's important for the court to understand the can of worms that following the argument of respondents leads you down, that the court should just do equity because alter shouldn't mean that they can't move it. And I simply think that, you know, especially in the area of property law, our jurisprudence is that people are bound by these things, and that they're bound by these things, you know, as Judge Johnson pointed out, in perpetuity, because that's what people agreed to. And when somebody
do you want to address counsel's argument that the it that you're referring to that cannot be moved is the right of, it could be construed as the right of access, ingress and egress, as opposed to just the physical location of the road?
And so
why isn't that a reasonable interpretation of the easement?
Because it really goes to the language, because it says on addendum page 7, it talks about that it's shown and labeled on exhibit A attached hereto and made a part of. You got a survey. It says this is where it is. Later on, it talks about it being a 24-foot wide gravel road. So we know what it is and where it is, and I respectfully, that makes it a defined easement. We can tell from this document where this thing is. If the people who had drafted this had wanted to make it an ingress and egress right, they could have done so. And they did not.
So your argument is that it's not a reasonable interpretation given the entirety of the document?
Absolutely. Based on its express language, we know where this thing is with specificity. And so it is not a nebulous right of access that could be moved around. It's a specific road of a specific dimensions in a specific location. It takes it out of the restatement. And it, as I think you correctly pointed out, we don't really even need to go to the restatement because there's a long string of cases that stand for the proposition that this is a contract. So if you contract for this thing, then you're bound by it. We can tell what this is. You don't have to play around with ambiguity and say, well, what is it and where is it? We know. This document knows, and every homeowner that bought into this association knew that, and it was recorded. It has been recorded since the inception of this development. So to go back and say, well, they didn't really mean it. What they really meant was ingress and egress, I think is just not supported by this record. Ultimately, appellants are asking that the court reverse the decision of the district court. This is not an easement that can be altered under 8.4, and it should be applied as written, which means that the district court's decision allowing the movement of this easement should be reversed.
Before you sit down, I wanted to ask for your response to Mr. Dwork's argument that the word alter is ambiguous.
I don't believe it is ambiguous, and I think that if you look to the, you know, part of our contract interpretation is you read the document as a whole. Further down in the document, I want to say the fourth paragraph, it talks about things like maintenance, and there's nothing in there like, that, for example, my point that it could have been paved had 5 of the 15 people agreed to do so. That's, I think, you know, what it's talking about. There's no, I do not believe that you can interpret alter, says it shall not be altered, to mean that you can move its location.
And was that issue something that was litigated in the district court or determined by the district court? That whether the word alter is ambiguous or not?
The district court, to my recollection, did not address that in any of its orders.
Counsel, just one other off-topic, maybe question, but was any consideration in all of this looking at school buses and how they run in that area now and how they'd have to run in light of the different roadways?
There was discussion about that, and it is in the trial record, not so much school buses but emergency response vehicles. And the testimony from TEG was that were they allowed to proceed with the concept plan and they were the ones to actually make the alterations, that they were going to bring them up to the now current Plymouth City standards and define those as based on the needs of emergency vehicles to navigate. So not school buses.
Wouldn't you maybe be required to throw in a cul-de-sac or two?
It wouldn't surprise me. That was the issue, was not the issue of school buses specifically. I do not recall being addressed at the district court level. It was the width and expansion for emergency vehicles.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within. That is our final case for today's oral argument, so the court is now in recess.